Clearly, the increased smuggling of heroin, fentanyl, and other synthetic opioids, along with growing rates of methamphetamine that are devastating communities across the United States, remains a critical focus. And at the border, we face changing trends in illegal crossings that impact security, exploit our laws, and challenge our resources and personnel. To put this aspect of our mission in context, one day of crossings, last Monday, December 3rd, highlights the trends that we are confronting. On that day, we saw the highest numbers of arrivals at our southwest border in years. 3,029 illegal entries and inadmissible persons arrived at our border last Monday. 85% of them crossed illegally. And I will tell you the truth, dear. Yeah, we both know truth don't belong here.
That was your new acting head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kevin McAleenan, testifying to Congress 4 months ago in his then role as Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection. McAleenan was promoted to run DHS Sunday by President Donald Trump, who reportedly pushed out Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen over mounting frustration that Nielsen's historically aggressive enforcement measures along the southern border were nonetheless not tough enough for Trump. Good Monday, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy spring, people.
Yay.
Happy Monday.
Hi, Matt.
Wow. You people are barely holding on.
Dude, the spring is trying to murder me, Matt.
Why? Are you like one of those terrible allergy whiners?
Yep, I'm an allergy whiner.
God, people in your fingers.
Death by seasons.
In addition to never hoping to talk about allergies in this podcast, I have I'm always crossing my fingers and hoping that we can maybe not talk about immigration for one of these episodes. But the president just can't seem to stop making news about his favorite issue. So over the past 24 hours, Trump has twice repeated his threats to close the border if Mexico doesn't do more to deter immigration caravans traveling north. And also tweeted out that our capital C country is all caps full, which is obviously a pretty interesting notion to any of us who've attempted to drive between El Paso and Beaumont, Texas. So maybe let's start right there, because that's kind of an interesting concept, and clearly the president likes to hit it. Catherine, as far as I know, there were about 230 million people back when you and Suderman were first hatched in the laboratory. There are now 330 million people. Are we in fact full?
We are not full. Our country is not full. I think there is a theoretical point at which a country could be full, but America, the United States of America, is gigantic. And what's more, like, obviously full does not mean geographically full. It does not mean all the people are sitting on each other's laps. But it's an interesting...
Like a Joe Biden rally.
Like a Joe Biden rally. Phew, too soon. You know, it's interesting because it uses like very kind of literal-minded rhetoric to convey an idea that's actually very, very abstract, right? Like when he says the country is full, charitably, what he means is something like... Our social services are at a breaking point, and also there are strains being put on some of the fundamental cultural elements that make this country strong, and we should be concerned about the long-term consequences of a dramatic increase in immigration. But by saying the country is full, it just evokes, and this actually gets us back to last week, it evokes people's sense of a need for personal space. It evokes a claustrophobia and a fear of, like, physically people in your house, in your yard, on your street. Which I think is very effective and has been very effective in the immigration debate.
Nick, you were at a debate last week, if I'm not mistaken, between or the week before, I forget, they all run together, Intelligence Squared, that featured, among others, arguing over whether Trump should get a second term, Jeff Flake on one side and Kris Kobach on the other, the latter of whom is a king hell immigration restrictionist. He was on Trump's...
From the state of Kansas, the overpopulated neo-Indian nightmare.
who somehow managed to not to deliver the state house of the state of Kansas to a Democrat running as a Republican in a super red state this past November. But this was one of the arguments. They argued over the kind of fate of the Republican Party in the state of California. And there's a fundamental difference of opinion on one side. The flake side is, hey, look, that's the future of the Republican Party. What happened in California, which is Pete Wilson, Prop 187 in the early 90s, and all of this happened then, and now there are no more statewide Republicans. There's no Republicans, period, even in Orange County, which is amazing for those of us who are old enough. And then the Kris Kobach thing is like, actually, no, the problem is that we brought in too many Mexicans, and then their taxes are too high, and they all moved to Texas. Where are you on that analytical divide there?
A couple of things. One is, you know, the Republican Party just and I don't care about the Republican Party, but it is getting older. It's getting whiter. And that, you know, there's a limit to how far they can go. I've said it a couple of times. I think I can't imagine Trump not winning in 2020 if he runs. And the Republicans might be able to squeak out a presidential win even in 2024. But if they don't change their rhetoric and their attitude, not simply towards immigration, but I think more towards the future and having a more positive, inclusive understanding of what it means to be American, they're up Schitt's Creek. In terms of the immigration debate, and I think, you know, what Catherine is getting at is really, it, from a libertarian perspective, is the most important question to ask. It's, you know, this is really about symbols more than anything. And there is a sense, and I think it's widely shared by people on the right and the left, but they take it in slightly different directions, that some, you know, we are in a weakened position as a country, and we are not capable of processing all of the traumas that are going on. People on the right tend to see this more as it's an invasion by people that were not used to invading the country, you know, coming from Guatemala and El Salvador and all of the, you know, and Mexicans. But on the left, I mean, Bernie Sanders also, you know, has recently been reiterating that he is not in favor of open borders either. Immigration is a populist issue, but I think the larger issue, and I think Trump is using immigration or has used it well, to speak to the fears and anxieties of a large number of people who feel like we don't have a clear path forward as a country. We have decent but low economic growth. Nobody feels like their jobs are secure. Nobody feels like their way of life is secure. On the left, everybody wants free Schitt. That's the answer to everything. And on the right, it's to shut down the border. And I think, you know, from a libertarian perspective, we need to figure out how do we give a different way forward through the set of policies and attitudes and temperaments that we
have. Suderman, Nielsen had a pretty draconian record. I think Dara Lind saying just the most aggressive enforcement of any DHS secretary in history. She served about 18 months. John Kelly, who probably was greeted with the same exact language, the most draconian enforcer in DHS history, also served about 18 months there. Both of them, to various degrees, enforced, defended, and then also kind of like dissembled or didn't exactly treat honestly about the administration's notorious family separation program. What does Trump's frustrations with his own, enactors of these policies tell you?
I think it tells us a couple of things. One is that Trump is not fully in control of his own administration. And this is one of the things we've talked about a lot, which is that, you know, it's a little bit difficult to talk about the Trump administration because the unitary executive, this is not. And so, you know, if you go all the way back to the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, there was this theory of the unitary executive, which was that the entire executive branch kind of flowed and stemmed entirely from the president and was simply sort of enacting his will at every level. And that's just very clearly not happening in the Trump administration. And to take us away from immigration just a little bit, just to sort of help flesh this out, I've been in small group settings off the record with quite high level Trump appointees, let's say in agencies. And one of the things that has come out from these, become very clear from these discussions to me, is that when Trump doesn't prioritize something, that gives appointees, director level people, a huge amount of discretion, which means that within the agencies, you have a very high level of variance under Trump, where some of the agencies are run very well, or run very competently, or have very clear goals, and some of them, you know, kind of clearly not. Because Trump just kind of isn't minding the store in the way that a traditional president is. On immigration, of course, he does care. And I just want to bring us back to when Trump made his announcement for president in 2015. You know, we all remember him standing on that escalator or whatever in Trump Tower, and he says, "When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity, and now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. They're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems." And then he goes on, you know, they're bringing these problem people. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're bringing rapists. And some, I assume, are good people, right? This is the core theme of Trump's campaign, of his presidency. This is the one thing that he personally cares about the most, which is treating Mexico as a kind of rival to be destroyed and to be beaten and humiliated. And that is where I think Trump gets kind of his personal sense of accomplishment from. The rest of it is just sort of stuff that the rest of the administration is doing, and he doesn't care all that much.
I think it's worth putting it in the larger context of the Republican Party, though, too. And you're right. I mean, he's got like some kind of bug up his ass about Mexico in particular. But
and it's not just this campaign either. I mean, this goes his rhetoric on this goes back decades in his books and in his other political campaigns.
I suspect that a lot of that is also because he was picking up on Republican rhetoric, which goes back at least to the 90s, where there were always people within the Republican Party. And it used to be a large number of people. And we've talked about, you know, the way that George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan both debated each other in 1980 in Houston over who would do more for illegal immigrants, because they were an integral part of the American economy and culture. But at least since the 90s, there has been a very vocal nativist group, anti-immigrant. They took over the pages of National Review throughout the 90s. I remember my predecessor at Reason, Virginia Postrel, was constantly fighting with people like Peter Brimelow, who finally got kicked out. He was even too bad for National Review and now runs VDare, a nativist site. This has been something that the Republican Party has been extremely anti-immigrant, specifically anti-Mexican immigrant and Latin American immigrant. George W. Bush was the weird outlier, and after he got reelected in 2004, tried to do comprehensive immigration reform and got his ass kicked, not by Democrats, but by Republicans. So I think Trump is speaking to this longstanding Republican thing, which as Matt was talking about, and I was living in California when Prop 187 came up. It was ugly. It was also bipartisan in California. I mean, people like Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and whatnot were all in favor of, you know, limiting the number of brown people coming into California.
So was Arianna Huffington.
Yeah, no. And so, I mean, this is where I think, you know, it's one of the places where the American century kind of went to die, and that, you know, the transformations, the globalization of the economy and whatnot shook up a lot of stuff. And that's what I think this is kind of speaking to.
Nick, I think that's exactly right. But I would just two things. One is that under Trump, and you talked about this, under Trump, the pro-immigrant faction in the Republican Party that existed and was often in leadership for a while has basically gone away. And that in addition, the hardliners, they looked more like Kirsten Nielsen.
Nope.
Kirsten Nielsen.
Doesn't matter. She's gone now.
I'm sorry. The hardliners wanted to act basically the way that she has acted. And Trump is frustrated with someone who has been a hardliner. And so Trump is further out there in terms of what he wants to do. There was no talk Peter Brimelow, as bad as he was, sort of flirting with outright racism as he was, wasn't talking about trade, about just shutting down the border completely out of spite.
This is also, though,
I wouldn't rule that out, though.
The threat to shut down the border, which is now, you know, it's always the exact form of the threat is always developing, right? Maybe it's next week. Maybe there'll be warning. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be a year's warning.
We'll let avocados
in.
They're going to let avocados in,
to avoid losing the millennial vote. Like, there's a, you know, the form of the threat is evolving sort of in the way of like bad parenting. Like when you're when you're constantly threatening a vague, very serious sanction that never comes if the kids don't shape up, and the exact definition of shape up is also vague. Like, that's what's happening right now. And so it's no surprise that, like, even if Mexico wanted to scramble to do whatever it is that Trump wants them to do, they couldn't, because the request for change is unclear. And even if they did it, there's absolutely no reason for them to expect that the sanction wouldn't then just evolve and be threatened for something else.
It's almost as if Trump is bad at making deals. You know, this is also bizarre.
Yeah, but it's also bizarre, too, because only a couple of weeks ago, and even back at CPAC, which is a little bit more than that, but Trump started flipping his immigration rhetoric to say, you know, the economy is going so well, we need more immigrants, and I want to bring in more legal immigrants and things like that. And that has kind of faded. And it's just very peculiar. And I think part of this is, you know, Every politicians in particular, and Trump is like this, where they want to be able to assert absolute control over, you know, kind of like over the waves. I mean, it's like King Canute writ large or something like that. You know, like, it's insanity. And then it peaks and eddies. And, you know, if we go back to an early thing, like an early axiom that Jack Schaefer, I think, coined in the beginning of the Trump years, when he starts focusing on one thing, you know, maybe there's something else going on that he's trying to keep us from thinking about. And I don't know what that would be in this case, but it's kind of peculiar.
Back to the kind of the weird depersonalized rhetoric. You know, the phrase "the country is full" isn't exactly about people or individual people. And I think the other place that we heard that this week, which I'm sorry, Matt, if I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but Bernie Sanders, who is asked, hey, are you open borders? Actually, it's asserted in a question that he's open borders. And then he says, au contraire, mon frère. And then he wraps up his explanation of why he is not, in fact, in favor of open borders by saying, there's a lot of poverty in this world, which is the most dehumanized possible way of talking about, like, there are people who are hungry and desperate and they want to come here. And if we let them, there might be bad consequences. Like, there's a lot of poverty in the world is I think exactly the wrong way to talk about it. Just like the country is full is the wrong way to talk about it. But I do want to talk with you guys about Bernie Sanders pushing back on the claim that he's open borders, because I think we've all been in that conversation too. I've certainly been in the conversation where someone says, hey, Reason Magazine is open borders, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a moment where, you know, for me at least, my ideal end state is open borders. My ideal end state is even a unilateral opening of the borders of the United States. But like Bernie Sanders, I often will reply and say, like, no one is actively proposing that right now. That is not the thing we're currently debating. What we're currently debating is, should we be lowering the caps on legal immigration, which is what we are doing right now, and should we be taking increasingly draconian enforcement efforts to the border, which we are doing right now? But that's a little weaselly, right? And so I guess I'm interested from you guys, like, what do you say when someone says, are you open borders?
Well, first, you know, Shika Dalmia, our colleague, has a good piece that is up at Reason.com right now about asylees, because that's also what we're talking about here. Because when we're talking about immigration, we're not actually, there is not a flood of immigrants, like legal, normal, regular immigrants coming here. That's not particularly out of control. There's a surge in people seeking asylum and refuge from Central American countries, which we have also, at the same time that we're saying they're horrible, we've cut off all kinds of aid that might actually help stabilize the situations in those countries so that fewer people want to leave. But she says, you know, let asylees come in with a condition that they, you know, let them work legally here. But with certain conditions. And that actually makes the most sense, because this is another subset of immigration. When you look at the rates of people who come here and apply for asylum, and they show up at the border and they say, I'm requesting asylum from, you know, my home country because something's fucked up there and I might qualify as an asylee here. The people then it typically, or it used to be the case where they would be let in, basically let into America, and they were given a court date. And depending on the cases, it was like between about 75 to 99% of asylees would show up for court proceedings where they might be told, you are not granted asylum, now get the hell out of the country. These are law-abiding people, and that's, you know, worth thinking about in this context. But I think when you talk about open borders, and Catherine, I consider myself open borders, and then I realize it's not a good term, because what it means is that for me, it's that anybody who shows up here, and they come through a border checkpoint and they present who they are, they identify who they are. And as long as they don't have a violent criminal record or a communicable disease, they are allowed to come in here and live and work legally. I guess people aren't talking about that, but that is my preferred immigration plan, and it would be really great. And it would be really great, especially now that we're in an economy that's not growing very fast, but has like effectively zero unemployment. I think it's exactly what would cure us. And this is where I think we've lost both, you know, whether it's Sanders or Trump. What they've lost is the narrative about immigration as a kind of form of alchemy, that we take the poor people and the wretched refuse, people who are uneducated, and when they get to America, they are transformed because of work, because of property, because of our culture. They're transformed into people who really prosper and do well, and also make America a little bit different, but a little bit better. And I think that's a vision that we need to, you know, really kind of, you know, reinvigorate.
To answer your question, Catherine, as bluntly as I can, I am not personally for open borders for the same reason, or similar reasons, let's say, as I'm not for, I don't know, polygamy or abolishing age of consent laws or whatever. It's because I'm not an anarchist. I'm an incrementalist ultimately, and I'm keenly aware of what sells in the public marketplace. And we live in a fallen world of laws as they exist, not laws as I would like them to be. And to completely shut down every single border crossing with the existing laws that we have right now, I think would not be a good policy idea. And further, I think that the phrase open borders as attached to libertarianism has created so much useless conversation about getting to the place where majority, not all, but many libertarians actually are on this issue, which is not precisely open borders. It is more like what Nick's talking about, vastly increase the number of legal immigrants, deregulate this, stop making it a crazy Washington thing where you like figure out the precise four-figure number from every crappy Central American country and this kind of stuff. Like, no, go in the opposite direction from that. Don't treat people who come in here like FedEx packages, which is the perennial great idea from Newt Gingrich to Chris Christie on down. None of that is necessarily an open borders position. And I think it has been a rhetorical mistake to embrace what strikes people as most normals as crazy. On a kind of fundamental level.
But open borders doesn't mean eradicating borders.
That's
it doesn't
how
mean
people,
not having borders. Yeah,
how
I understand
people
that.
Receive it. And if you're going to be marketing ideas out there and trying to persuade people, that phrase
yeah,
is terrible.
Yeah, so you say, but it's also you can reclaim, you know, reclaim names and reclaim terms. And I agree. I mean, I don't think we're fundamentally disagreeing about kind of the general policy, and it might be some of the rhetoric about it. But it's also I think it's a strategic defeat to simply say, well, I'm not going to talk about open borders, because you're right. We really do need to manage this to blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, no, fuck it. You know what? I mean, it's like all of us either have, parents, grandparents, great grandparents who came here in an era of relatively open immigration. And the presumption should be that if you want to come and work and live in America, you should be allowed to. And that's the proper libertarian perspective. I think it's the proper American perspective. And it's an argument worth having, because when people start, you know, they all start with the weasel words or saying like, well, I'm not against legal immigration. I'm just against illegal immigration. And then so, well, let's increase legal immigration. Oh, no, we can't do that because we don't have control of the borders, blah, blah, blah.
I don't think weasel words, though, right? I mean, I think that's actually a thing that's changed recently. It used to be true that when people said, I am, of course, in favor of legal immigration, they mostly actually were. I don't know. I think that's true.
I don't know. I don't know. Because, I mean, and that's like, you go back to that debate between Bush and Reagan in 1980, and it's like, people were upset about illegal immigration, but they were actually upset about legal immigration, because it is also true, and this is, the other thing is, you know, there are these large waves of immigration, and because of, for a variety of reasons, you know, from about 1930 until about 1970, immigration declined precipitously, mostly because of world events, which is another thing from a libertarian perspective, is to remind people that governments don't control borders any more than they control, like, the drug trade, illegal drug trade. These things are happening because of the decentralized decision-making, you know, processes of millions of individuals. But we've been in a long sustained period of relatively high immigration, and that causes a lot of cultural and social discomfort. And we need to come up with ways to kind of manage people's anxiety about them.
I'll send this one to Catherine. Trump clearly wants and has been talking about at various times, even bragging on a zero tolerance policy towards illegal immigrants, although he's frustrated that we haven't, or he hasn't been able to be zero tolerance enough. There's news just this morning as we were talking, I think, from NBC News that President Trump has for months urged his administration to reinstate large-scale separation of migrant families crossing the borders as a deterrent. So he's unhappy that we weren't separating enough families. He's going to do more to be even more zero tolerancy. And yet, as we heard in the opening clip, there is an increase of numbers of people coming to knock on the door in the South. Is there a lesson to be learned about the concept of zero tolerance as applied to enforcing or managing immigration?
I guess I think it's the same lesson to be learned about zero tolerance in all areas of life, which is that zero tolerance doesn't work, that prohibitions don't work, and they especially don't work when people really, really want something. And that thing can be sex or drugs or America. And
well put.
I was just immediately managing the imagining the next t-shirt.
I think I just came up with our new t-shirt. That this is something that we see over and over, that people attempts to restrict demand, right? Like the DARE program of immigration, the interdiction program of immigration, can be easily swamped by supply and vice versa, that it's a dynamic system. And in this case, lots of people want to come here from Central America because things in Central America are pretty bad for those people. And that's not something that the U.S. can control, although you could argue that there are various ways in which we could make the situation better or worse and have. But the healthy economy, which we are all, you know, cheerful about, is... and in particular, low unemployment is going to draw people to us, just as the dangerous places they come from are going to push them away. And sort of saying we're going to get tough, zero tolerance, is the same thing that we've said about a lot of things, and it typically doesn't work, and in fact creates a bunch of bad secondary consequences, including that people who probably shouldn't be a priority for enforcement get swept up. And here I'm thinking of, you know, the kid who brings a knife to cut his apple in his lunch and winds up caught in the zero tolerance weapons policy. I'm thinking of the, you know, the guy who has one old joint in the back of his, junk drawer that the cops find and add to his sentence for something else. So I think there are always going to be people who suffer more for zero tolerance policy, who are lower enforcement priorities, and also that the high enforcement priorities can get missed or just simply won't work.
As I always say, we need a zero tolerance policy for zero tolerance policies.
You're the worst. Hey,
I do want to add one quick little thing here, which is that the zero tolerance policy at the border was what was responsible for the wave of family separations, and that what Trump is looking to reinstate is mass family separation, where anyone who is caught for any reason is referred to the Department of Justice and then prosecuted for illegal entry, and that means that parents are separated from children. What Trump wants, what Trump likes, are dramatic, showily cruel policies that he can show off. Here, I am being unnecessarily cruel. This zero tolerance policy was talked about. I've had discussions with Republican officials from previous administrations. They've always rejected it because they thought it was simply cruel but ineffective. Trump, driven in part by Stephen Miller, his advisor, latched onto it because it was cruel, not because it was effective.
I also just want to do a quick product placement here, y'all. Today is the first day that you can pre-order Brian Kaplan and Zach Wienersmith of Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal's graphic novel called Open Borders. So if you want to understand this question better, maybe you need a comic book.
Maybe
there's
I do,
also to underscore what Peter was saying is that the zero tolerance policy has been ineffective, and that's also something worth discussing. And once one of the arguments is that as people recognize Trump is getting serious about that, they're making a rush for the border to try and get in before the last minute and things like that. But that's also, you know, what would an effective immigration policy look like? And this is also where, again, Trump is defining it as how many people can I block at the border? And that's actually, that has nothing to do with like American social policy or immigration policy. What we want is a country that is, you know, that is prosperous, that is peaceful, and that is growing, like both economically as well as kind of culturally and population wise for all sorts of reasons. And these policies are really, really bad. And the way he's framing it, we end up getting into a discussion about what a dick Trump is and how cruel he is and what an idiot Stephen Miller is. And actually, we should be having a different discussion about, you know, where do we want the country to, what do we want the country to look like in 5 years or in 10 years? And how do we both assimilate, immigrants who get here, and how do we acculturate as a society? How do we change? The America that we're in today is not recognizable to people from 100 years ago. And it's like in virtually every way is totally better because America changes in relation to the immigrants who show up.
But if Trump is being, and Stephen Miller are being cruel and idiotic, why not call that by their proper names?
I agree with that, but I'm saying it doesn't get us to a good immigration policy, because then you have Bernie Sanders, who may end up being president, and implementing his version of immigration restriction, which might not be as gratuitously cruel or as ineffective, but it's going to fuck up the economy and the growth of America, both as an ideal as well as like a real place to live just as much. And that's the conversation I think that we should
always have. I think you're right that these things should be forward-looking. At the same time, the reason that we're having the discussion is because the most powerful politician arguably in the world has certain predilections, campaigned on Mexicans mm-hmm. are drug dealers and rapists and yep. kind of terrible, trashy people, and is now attempting to reinstate a policy that he, an actual policy that was put in place last year, and he, in his power and authority as the president of the United States, wants to put it back, and it's worth talking about that.
Can we, though? I want to really quick put forward.
If I can just say one final thing about the ineffectiveness of Trump's immigration policy and rhetoric, is that he is turning America into a pro-immigrant country. And this is perhaps the silver lining. We've talked about this in the past. Is something like 75% of Americans, a historic high now, according to Gallup and Pew, think immigration is a good thing for the country. 65% of Republicans, record high again, 85% of Democrats. So, history is kind of ironic in a lot of ways.
Let's shift gears here to another aspect of.
Was that a gear shifting?
That
sound?
Was a truck shifting gears. Wow. Have you guys ever been in an old truck that shifts when it shifts gears?
You have, do you know how to drive a manual, yeah. Peter? That
I was
that.
I was the first time I learned. I was my dad taught me to drive was in a manual, and I burnt through like the master cylinder or something in a day. We switched to the automatic.
The clutch. Yeah. The master cylinder is a brake.
I don't know.
You might have burned through that system. Too.
That it wasn't good. Yeah. But then I did eventually learn to drive a manual.
Pete Welch obviously had a three on the tree. A Chevy, 64 Chevy pickup truck, or was it a Ford? It's unclear. So
Matt knows what that sound is.
I know what the sound is of a four-year-old saying, what happens if I go in this direction and the truck hits the front of the house? Neither here nor there.
Seems like that's right where we are, actually.
So part of Trumpian nationalism, one that might be a little bit more copacetic to the people on this podcast, was a open and early opposition during the campaign, at least, to certain types of nation building in far-flung shitholes, to use his phrase.
Shit houses? Shit.
Also shit buildings, shitbergs. So a couple of different news bits floating around out there that have relevance. One is that according to this morning's Washington Post, quote, American forces operating inside Libya have temporarily evacuated as clashes between rival militias raging on the capital's outskirts raise the specter of an all-out urban war, to which someone might say, oh, right, we had forces in Libya. kind of forgot we had troops there. Another one is a letter sent to the president last week, co-signed in part by Rand Paul and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's happening. To the president, encouraging him to actually follow through on his announcements of last fall or early winter to withdraw all U.S. troops from Syria, which has since been replaced by, let's keep 1,000 or 2,000 in as long as it takes. Rand Paul and Democrat Tom Udall have also introduced a bill to officially end the war in Afghanistan, terminate the authorization of use of military force there, bring all the boys and girls home. Finally, just this morning, and these are all a little disparate, but also not, the U.S. took the unprecedented step of labeling Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which is an official government entity, as a terrorist organization. What that is going to portend, it's hard to say right now, but I don't think it's going to be a folk song. At any rate, Nick, I want to start with you. We've had four consecutive presidents now who won a general election in part by campaigning to be less interventionist than the competition. George W. Bush, it's more of a coin toss with Al Gore, but I think if there's an argument to be made that his conception of a humble foreign policy was more humble than Gore's pro Iraq war pre the Iraq war. So four consecutive presidents, they won. They were able to use that as useful politics advantage in there, and yet when they get into office, most of them, and Trump is kind of the exception, have launched fancy new wars, or at least increased ground troops abroad, and have been really slow, if non-existent, on the whole withdrawal front. And we still can't seem to get Trump to withdraw people. To what do you ascribe this recurrent pattern?
The military-industrial complex, which has an intellectual or a media wing to it as well, and a lobbying wing that is gigantic. And I think one of the and to go just very kind of briefly to tie this to the previous conversation, when we focus on Trump as like a particular person, which we should be doing, and all of that, we also obscure the longer term trends that are, problems that you're pointing to. American foreign policy in the 21st century has been a complete disaster. Everybody knows it now, and public opinion is on the side of getting the hell out of all of these places and trying something different. But we have a rump group of anti-Trump, former administration people, as well as people in the public, kind of public eye, who keep talking about how, Trump is evil, but we have to maintain the specifically Republican foreign policy of George W. Bush that was largely kept intact under Barack Obama from now until end. And that's the most important thing in the world. That's what I attribute the ability to actually pull people out of combat. It's to the military-industrial complex with this media dimension on it that quashes all conversation that allows certain things to happen. And it's really problematic because this is not going to go away when Trump goes away. This is one of the most fundamental rethinks that has to be done in the 21st century. And we're not doing it on healthcare policy. We're not really doing it on education policy. We're not doing it on economic policy or the Fed or anything. And we really need to be doing it on foreign policy. And we're
Catherine,
not.
Catherine, the ultimate argument against withdrawing troops in Afghanistan, to be clear, now we officially have deployments of people there who were born in the 21st century, which is just insane. But the political problem, or the kind of public relations problem, which are intertwined, is that we leave Afghanistan. Afghanistan is going to absolutely go to the crapper even quicker than it is now. Taliban is going to restore power and they're going to start beheading not just statues, but, you know, 16-year-old girls. What say you, peacenik hippie?
So this is actually, I was about to go the totally opposite direction there, which is this is why, as a wee young thing in Washington, D.C., I supported the Iraq War, because I think it's sort of part and parcel with what we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast, which is an implied commitment in people who believe that our borders should be more open, if not totally open, which is that people outside of America, their lives and their freedoms matter too. And, you know, to the youthful and optimistic Catherine Mengu Ward of the Iraq War era, it seemed to me that if we could do the thing that was advertised at the time in that war, was which was to get in quick, save a bunch of people from tyranny, high five them to freedom and bail out, that that is the thing we should do, that we were maybe even morally obligated to do that thing. Now, it turns out the empirical claims were wrong. The empirical claim that we could do it at a relatively low cost was wrong. And in fact, that claim is wrong everywhere and always around the world.
Or that you can do it at all.
Or that you can do it at all.
I mean,
that's
like,
right.
It's not just
that's
the
right.
cost.
Or that, yeah. that it is even an easy or doable thing to remove an autocratic regime and replace it with a liberal democratic one when you are an outside force. So I think, you know, my impulse is actually to, like, tally up all the utils, right? My impulse is to say, like, well, okay, we're in there now. We have, like, a baseline condition. How can we improve the baseline condition the most? And whether it's American lives or Afghan lives seems to me to be of secondary consideration. That said,
utils for those who blessedly do not know,
utility points, the utilitarian calculus yes. about how much happiness or yeah. well-being you can create in the world.
Thank you. I needed that.
My temptation to sit down and kind of green eye shade this answer is counterbalanced by the fact that I think the answer is probably war everywhere and always imposes more costs than we can possibly imagine or anticipate, and that we should just do less war. Which means there's going to be high transition costs when we pull out of all these places, but that's probably still the right thing to do. That was a long
Peter,
answer.
You live in Washington. I have long had the...
That's like saying, Peter, as a intersexual black lesbian...
I mean, that's what...
Wait, how is it like that?
Except the opposite, because yeah. it's not true.
It's a way of limiting the universality and seriousness of your...
I identify as a...
So you live in Washington, D.C.
I identify as a Washington
untrue.
American.
Yeah, same.
He's a Washington American. He identifies, self-identifies. A. B. He has special insight based on that, which he's already dropped several times in this podcast.
That's true. He's always like,
so if you
I'm
have
in
a less
small gathering of fancy
view of the world. You know, Nick, I would say, if I was looking for insight at the University of Rutgers or on like the John Stearns era of the New York Mets, I would go to you in a spirit of benevolence.
You would say, Nick, as a person,
as a Rutgers American, can you?
As a Rutgers American.
As the Ernie D. Gregorio of political commentary.
Ernie D. Gregorio went to fucking Providence.
It's more of a physical resemblance than anything else. But anyways, no, Suderman. I, as a Californian, whenever I heard a military-industrial complex, not only did I associate it with the Lawrence and Livermore laboratories, just to go full Christic Institute on everybody
going
here.
On
but, yeah, I'm just here. If I have an audience of one, and that person's Nick Gillespie, yeah. and he's laughing,
and you do.
Then I win.
And you do.
No, I would say I would kind of roll my eyes and think, hippies, you know, here they come again.
That's Eisenhower's term.
I know.
That hippie. What a hippie. Ike.
I know. But like, that's the one thing that Ike did that the hippies yeah. liked. And so I kind of had a tendency to discount that as a concept. Like, it sounds kind of a little bit conspiratorial, if we're being honest about it. this is the big but. You feel the but coming? As you live in Washington and you're surrounded on all sides by the biggest boom town. I mean, I was in D.C., what, a couple of weeks ago? And going to my old neighborhoods around 14th and you and that whole corridor. My God! I've never seen a place gentrify as fast as Washington has over the last 12 years. It's nuts.
You literally live in Brooklyn.
I believe there are actually
Brooklyn doesn't
studies.
Gentrify that fast.
I believe there's actually been some studies showing that Washington, D.C. is gentrifying faster than any other city in the United States.
All right. Suck it,
it's
Brooklyn.
Unbelievable. So, yeah, suck it, Brooklyn. Yeah.
Just wait until Kabul is going to be gentrifying when we finally get the troops out.
At long last, Peter, since you have mentioned here on the podcast previously that there is not an infrastructure of intervention skeptics on the kind of policy front there in Washington. Is it the military-industrial complex? Is the conspiracy right in front of us what it always was? Ike and the hippies were right, and even Nick Ernie D. Gillespie.
I don't get that sense. And in some ways, given that I sort of focus more on domestic policy, maybe I'm just sort of missing something here. I will admit that this is not the issue where I feel most confident. Instead, I think there's a little bit of that, which is that Republicans like military jobs, and Republicans tend to represent districts where there are military jobs. And so that does certainly influence how Republicans think about things like military spending. And Trump's budget, of course, asks for a 5% increase in military spending. He's been, this has been a thing for him for basically since he started his campaign, is we need to ramp up military spending, restore it, right? The top brass at the Pentagon always sort of says, well, whatever spending level we're at, it's way too low. They especially sort of griped through the Obama years and said, well, we've just been cut down to size. We really don't have the capability to fight all 17 wars or whatever that we're fighting right now, plus, the Space War III, and you see Trump with Space Force and all of this stuff. I think it's actually much more cultural, though, than it is economic, or at least heavily cultural. And that is that Republicans have a, in some ways, quite healthy, in other ways, quite unhealthy respect for the military, and they just think it's awesome, and they want to spend money on it, and they want to spend federal money on it because they think, first of all, I think not entirely incorrectly, that's a core purpose of government, to provide for the common defense. That is what government should be doing. And secondly, they think, look, part of America's greatness, built into our national identity, what makes America awesome is the fact that we have the biggest and most powerful military the world has ever known. And then they, when you see Republicans around, I don't even know how to describe this, except to say that Republicans feel comfortable in military, in like a military culture around people who have military experience, who are currently in the military. And they think that, again, not without good reason in some cases, they think that military culture is special and good and should be supported with taxpayer dollars. And because lawmakers, the tool they have to do stuff is to spend taxpayer money on it. That's how they choose, in most cases, to support the things that they like, right? That's what, and so I like, when the option is spend more money on the military, spend the same amount, or spend less, if you like the military, if you think it is good for any reason, then your answer is going to be spend more.
And this is the stuff of classical political
theory,
right?
I think that's missing.
The stuff of some of the most fundamental texts about how to make a good polity are centered around the question of how to inculcate martial virtue in the populace. That this is considered not just a thing useful in and of itself when you are always at war, which people often always in world history were always at war, but also that you need those martial virtues for people to come back and build them into civic virtues. Now, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's an accurate portrait of either how to build a good polity or of the human soul, but it is a thing with a robust tradition that a legitimate person could believe.
I think, though, that you have to pull back and stop believing the rhetoric that the Republican Party is somehow particularly pro-defense spending or pro-military intervention, and the Democrats are not, that they're appeasers, that they want to roll over and let China or Russia or whoever do. The Democratic Party is as absolutely embedded into a military-industrial complex where they have just as many people in Democratic districts getting money. They have just as many generals. Bob Dole, as late as 1976, was railing against Democrat wars. This is part of the problem. If when we start buying buying into partisan rhetoric about this or that, and Donald Trump saying, oh, Obama has depleted the military, et cetera. He didn't deplete the military, and we didn't intervene less under Obama. I mean, we did it in different ways. And that's, Matt, that is why military spend, and it's not even military spending per se, it's military interventions. Because on a certain level, I would like to see the budget on everything in the federal government go down. But like, I don't really care if we build stupid new aircraft that will be obsolete by the time they finally get up in the fucking sky, like is going on with one of the biggest fighter plane disasters over the past 20 years. But it's like, we're actually going into other countries and killing people and destabilizing regions in the name of shoring up this or that. It's not a Republican versus Democratic thing. And I don't know that I believe in the deep state in any particular way, but that's what Eisenhower was talking about, is that this is something that is built into the very kind of fabric of government. And it's something that really needs to change. And to Peter's point, or what you were saying, I think it's true. There is not a lobbying force to say, let's get out of more places or let's not do anything, but a place to look. Go back and look at the shifts between the State Department budget and the defense budget over the past 50 or 60 years or since World War II. And a number of scholars point to the fact that there was a time when the defense was seen as somewhat subsidiary to State Department, to diplomacy was considered more important than actually being able to drop bombs or invade countries. That is totally flipped. And the State Department budget now is a rounding error in the defense budget. And that is part of the problem that we're talking
before
about.
Before I identified as a Washington American, I identified as a Florida American. And the part of Florida that I grew up in was a very military heavy area near Eglin Air Force Base, Pensacola Naval Air Center, a few others. Essentially, Eglin is the research and testing facility for the Air Force on the East Coast. So I grew up near a bombing range from just hear sorties flying over, you know, as I was going to sleep before school, see fighter planes practice over, you know, when you were out in the playground in middle school, right? Like you would just have fighter planes doing like tricks above your, above the school. So it's very, very military district in which it was part of just built into the culture. And it is, I think, not an accident that area, the panhandle of Florida, where there are a lot of military bases, is one of, if not the most Republican area of the country, and it is because there is a real connection between the Republican Party and sort of Republican party culture even, and military culture, that I think, I'm not saying that there's no connection. You're very, very right that the Democratic Party is embedded in the military and vice versa in a lot of ways. And I don't dispute that at all. But there is a real and distinct connection between military culture and Republican culture that comes out both in specific places and in people, but also that expresses itself in our politics.
I would just throw my regional two cents in, which is that growing up in the aerospace belt in Southern California, it doesn't map exactly like that. Orange County was Republican. Orange County didn't have a lot of defense. The South Bay, broadly speaking, where I'm from, Long Beach, Torrance, kind of south of LAX, which is the heart of the aerospace industry there, plus the Long Beach had a naval shipyard back then, was mixed. Mixed to Democrat, and then eventually got super Democrat. But you get these Democrat hawks like Jane Harmon would emanate from those places and spend like advocate invading absolutely everyone to make.
Is Joe Biden a Republican? I forget.
No, I mean,
you know, like is Hillary Clinton a Republican? I can't remember. You know, it's like, come on.
But just to throw a complicated out there. Since we had some false starts earlier today. And also during the false starts, I heard Suderman and Mangu Ward threatening to take up half of this podcast with their recommendations.
Promising,
on what
you mean?
Threatening. I'm going to kick off our what you've been consuming bit here, because the book that I am one third of the way through is one that I think all three of you might eventually want to read in different shades. It's called The Cult of the Dead Cow. by Joseph Menn, who writes about technology companies, security, privacy, and a bunch of other stuff. You might have heard of this book in passing because it came out with sort of a splash 2 weeks ago. Cult of the Dead Cow is the name of one of the original kind of shadowy, legendary hacker groups. It's kind of more of a culture hacker than anything else, but that started in the 80s in Texas. And one of its original-ish members turns out to be, it was exclusively revealed 2 weeks ago, Beto O'Rourke, which led to a round of pointless media controversy over a variety of things. But the book itself, which starts with a Beto O'Rourke fundraiser in Silicon Valley and at least one or other member of the Cult of Dead Cow, is actually this really fascinating, I can't yet say if it's a good book, so I haven't gotten through it, but look at kind of a tracing through 1990s, the creation of 1990s digital culture and the pre-culture before it, all the precursors and tendrils that end up coming out as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as you know, the 2016 Facebook, social media, sort of Russia stuff, the current kind of panic that we're living through. Joseph Menn is much more pessimistic about all of these things and kind of dark about the current state of affairs, about privacy and all these things, than I think most of us on this podcast are. So I would be curious to see where his conclusions go in. But associate it with a column over the weekend by Ross Douthat from the New York Times, kind of making the argument that 1999 was the last good goddamn great year because of movies and culture and all these things, and mostly because he was 18 years old back then. But it kind of it overlaps.
Believe he was 19. I was 18.
It overlaps with something that Nick, you know, Nick laments and that I lament, which is like, hey, the 90s were awesome. And like lately it seems to suck. And it's not just because we're getting old and sad. But anyways, it's well, I know that, right? It's fascinating.
Narrator voice. Yes, they are getting old and sad.
It's fascinating for all those reasons. And I think that all three of you would find it interesting. So with that said, Catherine, inflict.
So I want to talk about a Suderman recommendation, which I watched this weekend because also Twitter got all up on me about watching it. So thanks, Jen the Libertarian, which is Love, Death, and Robots, which it sounds like is the most perfect Netflix series ever to be targeted at me ever. And it's not that. However, my big question is, first of all, why is it so hard to write even moderately acceptable dialogue? Like, this whole series is amazing. The concept is amazing. It's essentially a collection of shorts. They are all animated. They are done in every different style you could possibly imagine. They are somewhere between 5 and 15 or 25 minutes each. They are just addictive and delicious and fascinating and visually compelling. And every single word out of every person's mouth in every single one of them is dumb. So I would just like to ask, why is it so hard to write good dialogue? I don't have an answer. I just want to throw that out there. However, the thing that this series made me think about and that I want to talk about just very, very fast is the future sort of like funny and messy, or is the future like just a like super serious blood splattered nightmare? And the answer to me is so clear that the future is funny and messy, and there are so many good funny and messy bits in here, which is why I really like it. There's like ironical robots, and like there's a whole thing about why you probably shouldn't try to kill Hitler if you have a time machine, and then there's just like 1,000 pairs of tits covered in blood, and it's just horrible. It's so horrible. It's like just blood splatter on everything. And I really don't think the future is one in which there's blood splatter on everything. And I wish that we could rebalance our vision of the future a little bit more to the messy, funny future in which yogurt takes over and writes a plan to eradicate the national debt, which humans predictably fail to implement
successfully. Not just humans generally. Politicians specifically.
There's literally a funny little short about yogurt being bad at debt, or yogurt being good at debt planning and humans being bad at execution. It's great. Everybody should watch it. It's amazing. It's not my fault that the dialogue is bad. The end.
I would vote for Activia in
same, right? Like, let's, yeah. So anyway, I think that this is like it was a super cool study in the future of TV. It was a super cool study in the future of science fiction. It was the first time that I have seen short stories done visually really, really well.
So a bunch of them are actually based on short stories by science fiction authors who I know you read. John Scalzi wrote The Yogurt Story and The Three Robots. A couple of other folks who are sort of well-known in the science fiction community. Another interesting thing about this is so that you can look on Wikipedia or on your Netflix queue and you can see the order of the episodes. But the order is different for different people, and so they randomize it.
What?
So initially there was some worry.
I actually had a whole bunch of deep thoughts about why the one they presented first was first.
Yeah. So initially there were some people who noticed this and wondered whether they were guessing your sexual orientation, whether you got the gay
future,
story,
by the way, is
or
full
the
of,
straight story.
The future is
first.
Full of like really cool, like sexy butch lesbians, according to this series also. So just FYI, that sounds great.
But it is a kind of it's a fantastic experiment. I don't think every episode works. It's kind of uneven. It's a little bit too grimdark at times. But it's fun and it's interesting, right? And it's hard to think of anything that like it that you've ever seen before. And but at the same time, if you are a science fiction reader, especially a reader of science fiction short stories, no, it's exactly like that. It's like Gardner Dozois's annual like best of best of science fiction,
but again,
in animated form.
I cannot emphasize enough. Like my husband, walked into the room during a few different ones of these, and every single time he walked into the room, the dialogue was so cringeworthy that I wanted to turn it off because I was embarrassed that I was being seen watching it. And this is the man I'm married to. He knows I watch embarrassing shit, so it was that bad.
Nick, what Bob Dylan re-release have you been listening to?
I actually did listen to a bunch of Dylan in the early 70s when he fled Columbia and hung out at Asylum Records for a while. So this is stuff like Planet Waves that he did with the band. But what I picking up on something Catherine was talking about, I too believe that the future and the thing that I'm reading I'll get to is that the future is messy and it's mostly comic or it's so weird. And there's a great Antonio Gramsci quote, the Italian Marxist who was a victim of Mussolini's purges and highly influential. But he talked about how it between the dying of an old order and the emergence of a new one, just kinds of all sorts of weird shit happens. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that like the rise of Donald Trump and the rise of all sorts of just weird stuff that goes on all the time. You know, we're in that transition. We're in a liminal moment yet. And it might be similar to the way that the old left and the new left broke in the late 60s and whatnot. And I'm positive about the future, but it is going to be messy and funny. And I'm reading Bret Easton Ellis has a new essay collection. It's not even really a collection. It's a sustained essay called White that comes out at official publication date is April 16th. And he is almost exactly my age. He's like 55 or something like that. An icon of the 80s, end of the 90s. He managed between Less Than Zero and American Psycho to create two of the novels, which also had movie versions that are different from the books, but, you know, like some real staying power in kind of American cultural memory, particularly Patrick Bateman and American Psycho, a book that is heavily indebted to Donald Trump. It's kind of written in Trump's 1980s America, and then the movie came out in the 90s. But he among other things, he's gay and he has a millennial boyfriend, and he's constantly talking about how like the millennial guy doesn't understand what has been lost, but also what has been gained in American culture, because there's no sense of history. And it's White is this incredible remembrance, Matt. You'll love it because it's a lot of it set in Southern California about the weird anarcho freedom that young people had in the 70s and part of the 80s as latchkey, basically as latchkey kids, where nobody was paying attention. A lot of that got lost. Some of this is kind of free range parenting stuff, but then it's also that younger people today are demanding or expecting certain things without understanding where kind of wealth comes from, where cultural meaning comes from and whatnot. And as a result, we're in this kind of weird place where things are actually really pretty good, but nobody understands why or where to go forward. And this is, for me, I've been thinking a lot about this lack of a national narrative, which is not you know, like an old one where it's like you have to be white and you have to be middle class and you have to be straight and you have to show up, you know, work at IBM or AT&T or go to war or anything like that. But we are splintered in such a way that it's, you know, there's a lot of cacophony going on. And I think the question, you know, we should all be asking is what is the story that we can tell about America that actually allows, you know, these fucking Guatemalans to show up and in 20 years be bitching and moaning about how their kids don't really understand what it means to be American. And White by Bret Easton Ellis is a pretty brilliant kind of exegesis of this moment. And I think a lot of the contributing causes and possibly some answers. And in many ways, it's he mentions Joan Didion in her collection of essays on the 60s, the White Album. And in many ways, his book is kind of similar to that. So that's what I'm reading.
Suderman, in addition.
Yes. So I saw a movie that should appeal to everyone on this podcast for completely different reasons. That is, it's Cold War, which came out last year.
Mm. It's Sold.
A Polish film by director Paweł Pawlikowski. It's a romance. It's a movie about love, art, and communism in that order. It is a kind of cross-border romance set first in Poland and then in Paris through the late 40s, through the 60s, kind of during the Cold War era. Starts in Poland where there are auditions being held for a state-sponsored folk music troupe. So they collect all these youngsters from the countryside. And of course, the kind of slightly older male musical director picks a young woman and they fall in love. And then there's and they produce the shows they produce are just incredible. I mean, the music in this film is just great. I mean, incredibly moving. And part of what they do is they reinterpret throughout the eras all of these old Polish folk songs, first into these kind of grand operatic things and then later into kind of jazz standards. And so, of course, they put these things on and they're beautiful. And then what happens is their communist minders come and say, well, this is, of course, wonderful and you are doing an excellent job. And wouldn't it be great if you could sing songs about the glorious revolution and its leaders? And of course, they have a political director. The artists kind of resent this, but they have a political director. And so you see them start to restructure their shows around these kind of absurd political displays, right? And so in part, it's about the ways that politics interrupts art. And then, of course, the two of them split up as they try to escape communist control. And then it becomes about the ways that communism and that the state interrupts and makes difficult their lifelong passion for each other. And so it's really a beautiful and fascinating movie about the human instinct to love and to make art and to follow your passion and the ways in which communism in particular, but the state generally, always gets in the way.
Anyone who thinks that communism is good for the sex, as was being bandied about this past year for some reason, the New York Times, elsewhere, or art, should take a cue from Dick Cheney. And that's all I'm going to say about that. That's all the oblique Nick Gillespie references that we have time for today on the Editor's Roundtable of the recent podcast. Go and do some Google image searching on Ernie D. Gregorio and also Basketball's Don Ford. Please leave comments
or
about that.
Or don't. That would be fine, too.
Or don't, I guess. That would be fine, too. Keep on listening. Thanks for taking us this far. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Do 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 do.